You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Brookings Institution and the African Growth Initiative. My name is Mwangi Kemenyi. I am the director of the African Growth Initiative. Today we are very lucky to have two distinguished panelists to discuss an issue that is very important to Africa. We at the African Growth Initiative, our main focus is on how to deal with the problem of economic growth in Africa. We are interested in, you know, to transform the African economies to see that we create jobs and improve the quality of life in Africa. But we also know that to be able to do that, despite that we have the fact that we have a lot of resources, we cannot be able to create wealth unless we create an environment of peace and stability and where people are actually able to live without always going into wars. If you look at the African record over the last couple of years, you find that we had a lot of conflicts, whether it's in Central Africa, in Congo, Central African Republic, Chad, Ivory Coast, Niger Delta, Somalia, Sudan, and all these, some of them ongoing. The impact of these conflicts, not just on the humanitarian, just the humanitarian impact in terms of the suffering and the deaths and so on, but also the impact on human development overall in terms of economic growth, ability to conduct, to invest in those countries, is quite serious. And we think that even the empirical evidence does show that these conflicts have been a major hindrance to our progress. It's not a question of resources, but how we live as communities in peace is quite important. So how do we deal with these conflicts? First of all, in terms of preventing them, but also in a resolution. And today we have two distinguished panelists, who know the terrain very well, and we would like to hear from them and exchange ideas on how to proceed with the broad topic of the role of African regional regional organizations in dealing with these issues. The first speaker, the main speaker, is Dr. Ruhakana Rugunda. And I will not go through all his bio. I hope you have that. But I was looking at all his what he has done, and it's just amazing. He's the training as a medical doctor, practiced in Washington, D.C., practiced in as a medical doctor in Kenya, served in the Ugandan government in various capacities as a minister. It's just incredible in terms of the service. But he just finished his term as the president of the United Security Council, as Uganda was a member of the United Security Council these past 2 years. And prior to his appointment as permanent representative in January 2009, he was the Minister for Internal Affairs, 2003-2009, and has extensive experience in government and public service. As I said, he has served in water, in public works, and so many of those ministries in Uganda. So again, I will not go over, but clearly a distinguished career, very experienced in terms of dealing with this type of conflicts. And I noticed also something I didn't know, that he actually negotiated with the Lord Resistance Army, which of course we know what that is been a pain for a lot of the Ugandans. So welcome, Ambassador, and thank you very much for joining us. The next speaker is John Hoover, who currently directs the Office of Regional and Security Affairs at the Bureau of African Affairs at the State Department. I also noticed that, John has actually served the countries there. He's very experienced in both, particularly the countries in Uganda and Kenya. So he also knows that area. And from 2008 to 2010, was Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Kampala, Uganda. From 2004 to 2008, he was the counselor for Economic Affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Kenya. And in 2008, he won what is called the Herbert Sussman Award of Excellence in International Economic Performance for his reporting and commercial advocacy in support of African efforts to enhance connectivity to the World Wide Web. So they have varied experience at once. So again, as I said, I'm not going to go to all these details. The way we will conduct this forum is that Dr. Ruguda will talk for about 20 minutes, and then Mr. Hoover will comment. His U.S. experience, but also on the discussion by Dr. Ruguda. So we are very happy to welcome Dr. Ruguda today. Thank you very much.
Mr. Mangi, the Director of Africa Growth Initiative. Mr. Hoover, the Director of State Department. Distinguished participants, ladies and gentlemen. As you have heard, I will discuss some issues concerning the role of the African Union and the regional or sub-regional organizations in Africa in prevention and resolution of conflicts. Many of us, all of us, are acquainted in one or another what causes conflicts. The specific details why conflicts are caused may vary. However, the general reasons are often economic or political or social. And these reasons are further complicated and interconnected with poverty, with bad governance, and also with weak states. When there are weak states, anybody attempts to take the law in his own hands, and the chances of conflict increase. And perhaps the question of weak states can be better illustrated by a country like Somalia, which for the last 20 years has not had one organized state governance, but has been under different warlords. And therefore, this creates seeds for conflict. There has been conflict in the world, but in the last 10, 20 years, or in the last perhaps 50 years, Africa has had a lion's share of many of these conflicts. Why have conflicts occurred in Africa? The main cause, there used to be the usual conflicts among communities, but the major one really came about with the invasion of colonialism. And in different parts of Africa, you find wars of resistance against colonial occupation. This was in South Africa, you know this, the Shaka and other wars. In Kenya, Mau Mau was resistance movement against colonialism. And in many parts of Africa, in Uganda, the Kabarega Wars against British colonialism. So that was one period of resistance against colonial invasion. The second took shape in actual struggles for independence, and again, these wars took different shapes. The most clear one was the Portuguese colonies, who waged wars for independence in Angola, in Guinea-Bissau, in Cape Verde, and not only in Africa, even in East Timor, to ensure that people were liberated. Wars of independence also were waged in other countries like Zimbabwe. But in places like South Africa, one can't call this a war of independence because South Africa was technically independent, so it was a war for freedom, a war to be free by the African majority who were under the shackles of apartheid. We have also had what one may call proxy wars. proxy wars for the current generation may not mean a lot of sense, but those of us who were present during the sharp days of competition between the two main superpowers and East and West conflict, this became very, very clear. And war in Angola, for example, was not a war for independence, because Angola got independence, it's true, through armed struggle, but the most fierce wars took place after independence. And this was mainly between the MPLA, which was in government, supported by the Soviet Union, and the socialist communist world, and Cuba, and you had UNITA, which was struggling to capture power and was supported in different subtle ways by the West. But we have also had wars in independent countries, other wars which I would not call proxy wars, but which I call wars for liberation. And Uganda is a case in point, where in 1981 and even early in 1979, there was a war to liberate Uganda from Idi Amin, and the subsequent government of Milton Obote. But there have also been wars between states or between countries. And the more recent illustration is the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea, where there was struggle for a small piece of territory, and yet many people from both sides were killed in this conflict. So the wars have been very costly, of course. We have lost many millions of people. For example, it is estimated that in Sudan alone, about 2 million people died because of the war in the Sudan. So you can imagine what the African loss has been. Millions were, of course, injured, many disabled, and very many internally displaced. And as we speak now, Africa still has about 30% of the global internally displaced people. Out of the 26 million people estimated to be internally displaced, 11.6 of these are within Africa. And of course, there have also been many refugees as a result of these conflicts. I'm glad that this is a center that focuses on economic issues, and the economic loss of brought about by these conflicts needs to be properly assessed. Apparently, a study by Oxfam and a Safer World estimated that these wars are costing Africa about $18 billion per annum. I do not know whether this figure is correct. My own assessment is that this could be an underestimation because the expenditures on military alone are very colossal. The destruction of the infrastructure as a result of these conflicts, very, very high. And, of course, loss of investment. No one wants to go and invest in an area where there is conflict. And therefore, you have some kind of paralysis in the economic activity of the countries affected because of the conflicts. I would urge Mr. Mwangi that your institute should give us more accurate figures about the losses that Africa is suffering or has suffered as a result of these conflicts. We think these figures are important because they will provide important ammunition in the cause for preventing conflicts and also in resolving conflicts. Now, who is responsible for containing, controlling, and preventing and resolving conflicts? We believe that you need a global mechanism to handle these issues. You need an African mechanism. You need mechanisms at the national level, and also you need the involvement of communities. It's true, at a global level, the United Nations Security Council has the responsibility of ensuring global peace and security. On the African continent, the African Union takes this responsibility. And African countries have said, we want the continent to be stable, we want to be democratically ruled, we believe in the rule of law, and we also want to respect the human rights of people and to ensure that there are no unconstitutional changes of government. And with these parameters put in place, then you have a conducive environment for economic activity and subsequent prosperity for the population. Does Africa have these institutions to prevent and to resolve conflicts? There is the African Peace and Security Architecture in place, which is helping Africa, which is a framework to help Africa resolve these conflicts. And under this architecture, you have the African Peace and Security Council based in Addis Ababa, and you have also a panel of the wise. Actually, currently it is led by President Mbeki and has Abdulaziz Salam, former President of Nigeria, and also President Buyoya. We think they are doing good work, and Africa is also mobilizing forces so that it can be able to deploy forces as and when it becomes necessary. In doing all of this, Africa and African Union is not alone. Africa is doing this work through and with regional economic groups. They were regional economic groups, but they have actually also now an inbuilt mechanism for resolving and for preventing conflicts. And the economic groups that I'm talking about include ECOWAS in West Africa, SADC in Southern Africa, IGAD in the north, in the Horn of Africa and partly East Africa, COMESA, East Central and Southern Africa, and Economic Community for Central Africa, mainly Rwanda, Burundi, and DRC, and International Conference on the Great Lakes, and finally the Economic Community for East Africa. These are economic groups essentially, but they have all realized that unless there is stability, you'll be wasting your time to talk of economic development. And they have now become major instruments in ensuring that there is stability in their respective countries and regions, and subsequently there is economic development. And we have said that the regional groups are very, very critical in the resolution of conflicts because they are near. There is geographical and political proximity to the areas affected. For example, when IGAD is playing an important role on the situation in the Sudan, the IGAD countries, Kenya, Ethiopia, Uganda, are just around, and they are likely to understand better the situation than somebody from Greenland or somebody from Belize. And they also have capacity to respond quickly. Because of being near, they can respond quickly to certain situations. And also they have special knowledge of the underlying causes of the conflict and the dynamics of conflicts in that region. So those are very positive things. But of course you can say, Yes, they may have those advantages, but they may also have their vested interests in the situation, their own biases, and that could complicate the mechanism. Instead of making it easier to resolve issues in the region, they may become more complicated, yes. Whereas that problem is there, I think the dominant line has been a more positive way of resolving issues. One complication I can illustrate is that of DRC. When there was conflict in DRC about 15 years ago, in the 90s, instead of the usual regional or groups solving the problem, you had Rwanda and Uganda in DRC supporting some liberation movements, two of them. Then you had Namibia, Angola, and Zimbabwe in supporting the government. So you had many African countries in same country fighting literally against each other. And this obviously became a big problem. But I'm glad that after some time they realized that it would not help anybody to continue this fight. And through the Lusaka Accord of 1999, all these countries agreed on one common position that eventually brought peace in DRC, relative peace, because there are still some problems even now. Of course, Africa is not doing this alone. Africa is doing so with full understanding and full support of the United Nations, and United Nations Security Council in particular. However, there is increasing ownership of these mechanisms in Africa. I'll give just one or two examples. The United Nations has troops in the Sudan. In Darfur, they are under UNAMID. UNAMID is a hybrid force between African Union and the United Nations, headed by Dr. Gambari, who actually comes from Nigeria, but is a senior official of the United Nations. Then you have UN troops in southern Sudan and in Sudan, overseeing the implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. This one is headed by Herman Kerios, who originally comes from Eritrea and is also a senior official of the UN. In order to ensure that the relationship between UN and AU are intimate and mutually beneficial to both organizations, the United Nations Secretary General has just appointed Ambassador Zakare Mwita of Kenya to become the Assistant Secretary General representing UN in Addis Ababa to smoothen that relationship. And in the case of Somalia, Ambassador Mahiga of Tanzania has also been appointed as the special representative of the Secretary General in Somalia. So the idea is that while the UN and AU are working together, there is increasingly more and more ownership of some of these operations by deploying joint African Union forces, by deploying distinguished African mediators like Basole of Burkina Faso, who is heading the peace talks on Darfur that are being held in Doha. Some of the regional groups have carried out their own specific tasks, and they have done so, in my view, in a very impressive manner. ECOWAS, for example, in 1999, deployed its forces and ECOMOG in Liberia, and they literally pacified the situation until the UN came in to deploy its troops. The same ECOWAS in Sierra Leone in 1997 deployed its forces that stabilized Sierra Leone and the UN came in, but after the situation was stabilized. And both Liberia and Sierra Leone, in my view, are doing well to stabilize and to rebuild their economies and to bring prosperity for their people. I will just illustrate by one or two countries the role of the regional groups. Case of Burundi. Burundi has been in problems for many years, but the East African community decided, under the chair actually of Uganda, to take the lead and sort out that problem. And they appointed President Mwalimu Nyerere, he had just retired, to be the facilitator. Later on, when he passed on, Mandela actually took up this responsibility, and who subsequently passed it on to Zuma. But through that cooperation between the East African community and South Africa and SADC, Burundi has over the years emerged out of the problems. And as you all know, a few months ago, there were elections, and they went relatively well, and Burundi is stabilizing and going ahead. But primarily with the region playing the primary role with support of the UN. The other country that one should also point out is the Sudan. The Sudan has been fighting for more than 50 years, literally. The war started in 55 and ended in 2005, when the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, under the supervision and the guidance of IGAD and the international community, was reached, and both parties agreed to lay down their arms. And for the last 5 years, there has been relative peace in the Sudan, and we expect and hope that in January, when they hold the referendum on the 9th, this peace in the Sudan will be further consolidated with one Sudan if they vote for unity, or with two states if they vote for independence. There are many other cases that one can illustrate. Because of time, I will not go into them. Let me, however, highlight one thing, that we have seen complicating factors in the search for peace in Africa. And some of the complicating factors that have emerged and are so instrumental are issues of drugs. When the United States put its foot down against drug dealers, mainly in Latin America, they found an easier route to go through West Africa, taking advantage of weak institutions in place, weak security, weak border controls, and the like. And it is believed that the recent deaths, actually, of military and political leaders in Guinea-Bissau may have been not just political, but actually related to issues of drug trafficking and drug manufacture. How is the situation now? Is it getting worse or getting better? You know, Chairman Mao Zedong, in his early days, said, there is turbulence under the sky, and the situation is excellent. There has been a lot of turbulence in Africa, heavy turbulence. About 20 years ago, there were about 20 wars going on simultaneously in Africa. As I speak now, there are about 4 going on. So although they are still going on, the fact of the matter is that it's very significant improvement from about 20 to about 4. And which are these 4 that I'm talking about? The Sudan, in Darfur. DRC, there is still some instability. Somalia definitely requires some attention. And in the region, there is Lord's Resistance Army. The Lord's Resistance Army was a rebel group, a unique rebel group, with no clear political objectives, but with one manifesto. rule Uganda under the order of the Ten Commandments. But what they did in practice was the exact opposite of what the Ten Commandments tells us to do. Anyhow, these four that are going on are being managed, in my view. And it's a question of time they will come to an end. And I think this has come about because of the common position taken by UN and by AU and regional economic groups all together. This harmony, this synchrony of understanding and also of action has helped in bringing about the end of these conflicts. Now, as I come to close my remarks, I better make two short points. One, has the situation been okay? Is it continuing to be okay, or there are some issues for concern? I think there are some issues for concern, and for because of shortage of time, I'll just mention two. The first one is Western Sahara. This is where the African Union has disagreed with the United Nations and, to some extent, the international community. And because of that disagreement, a solution is not immediately seen. And the reason is very simple. The United Nations in 1991, under Resolution 690, decided to send a team, MINUSO, to Western Sahara to conduct a referendum so that the people of the Western Sahara can decide whether to be independent or to join Morocco. Because Morocco occupied Western Sahara in 1975 after the Spanish colonialists left. There is a problem. Morocco continues to occupy Western Sahara, but Africa recognizes Western Sahara as an independent state. But the Western countries and some other countries still more or less recognize Morocco as the legitimate force there. If Africa and the West agree and the UN agree, then I think a solution will be found. Otherwise, this is still a problem. The second problem, where there is a problem, where there is an issue, is Somalia. And again, there is a bit of a difference between Africa and the rest of the world. The difference is here. All of us recognize Somalia as a big problem. But in our own view in Africa, we think that the rest of the world has put more attention on controlling piracy, fighting piracy, than dealing with the piracy from its source, its base, mainland Somalia. Africa firmly believes that we should deal with the mainland, pacify it, then piracy will disappear. It has taken us some bit of time to persuade the rest of the world. I hope they will be persuaded soon. Uganda and other African members of the Security Council have continued to urge the United Nations to give more support to Africa's capacity to deal with the problems and to resolve them. And we believe that Africa has adequate mechanisms, and all it needs is reinforcement in terms of resources to ensure that this capacity is built up to the full. We believe it is just a question of time. Africa will be soon in charge of its capacity to prevent conflicts and to deal with conflicts. And then dealing with conflicts and pacifying the continent will obviously mean a stable Africa, and with a stable Africa, then there will be sustained economic development, which we believe will be rapid, which will ultimately result in prosperity, not just for Africa and Africans, but for humanity. I'm very optimistic about the future of the African continent. I thank you.
like to thank the Brookings Institute for having me here today. This is my first time here. I've been serving overseas for quite some time. But when I came in and I saw Ambassador Rugunda and I saw Dr. Suruma, who were both ministers in Uganda when I was there, I felt like I was at home. You know, it was kind of a nice feeling. We have a little Uganda mafia up here. It's nice. But thank you. I'm going to start with a sort of a confession or an excuse up front. I'm still fairly new to my job, and as Mr. Mwangi alluded to in my bio, I sort of have more of an econ background, so security is something that's I'm still learning about. I'm a little embarrassed to be called an expert and to be up on this this stage with others who are experts, and also in the presence of my old boss, Ambassador Mark Bellamy, who really is an expert on security issues in Africa. But I'll give it a shot. I'd like to start by, if you'll indulge me, I'm going to read several quotes. I'll just read these. We must start from the simple premise that Africa's future is up to Africans. All of us must strive for the peace and security necessary for progress. Africans are standing up for this future. We welcome the steps that are being taken by organizations like the African Union to better resolve conflicts, to keep the peace, and support those in need. We encourage the vision of a strong regional security architecture that can bring effective transnational forces to bear when needed. America has a responsibility to work with you as a partner to advance this vision, not just with words, but with support that strengthens African capacity. We stand ready to partner through diplomacy and technical assistance and logistical support. End quote. Some of you probably could guess where those quotes came from. They came from President Obama's speech in Accra, Ghana in July 2009. And I took the time to read them to you because, you know, in all of our countries, there's often a gap between what our leaders say and then what the governments actually do. It's a little discouraging. It's often the case. But as someone in my new job who thinks about peace and security issues in Africa pretty much every day, every minute of every day, I can honestly tell you that there isn't much of a gap between those words from President Obama and what we actually do on the ground. These aren't just inspirational words from a charismatic political leader and not much else. They infuse and inform what we do day to day, not just at the State Department in my office, but in other parts of the U.S. government as well. It really informs what we're doing with African governments and with regional organizations to foster peace and security on the continent. When I say the U.S. government, I'm speaking principally about the State Department, USAID, and, of course, the Department of Defense, including the new U.S. Africa Command. But in our totality, we are working under the assumptions and the concepts that come out of those quotes. First, Africa's future is up to Africans. Ambassador Rugunda just said it, and we agree with 100% that Africans have the will and the capacity to prevent and resolve conflicts on the continent. So our business, as President Obama said, isn't to do it ourselves, but to be a supportive partner to prevent and resolve conflicts in Africa. The President also said we welcome the steps that are being taken by organizations like the African Union to better resolve conflicts, etc. So engagement with the AU has really become a priority under the Obama administration, not just the AU, but also the regional, sub-regional communities like the EAC, SADC, ECOWAS, and SEAC. On the AU, we established an independent diplomatic mission to the AU in December 2006. I think we are the only non-African government to do that. I believe the EU has a dedicated mission at Addis also, but we're the only bilateral that has a dedicated independent mission to the AU. And that's our principal means for engaging with the AU. That mission is led by Ambassador Michael Battle. It's growing as our engagement and our dialogue grows with the AU. We also have an American peace and security advisor embedded in the AU, and the AU recently accepted an offer to embed another civilian disaster planning expert at the AU, at the AU Peace and Security Division. And then our engagement is also follows less formal mechanisms. My boss, Assistant Secretary Johnny Carson, speaks to the AU leadership all the time, pretty much every week, just to make sure there's a free-flowing dialogue and to help us, to the extent we can do it, sync up with what the AU is doing. We want our policies and our statements to be as close to what the AU is doing as possible. President Obama said, we encourage the vision of a strong regional security architecture that can bring effective transnational forces to bear when needed. Ambassador Rugunda just talked about that architecture. We are, again, stepping up our engagement and our support to that architecture. It's not just word, it's deed. I think I'll probably go over the time that's allotted to me if I went through all of the programs and policies and activities that the U.S. government as a whole is doing to support Africa's regional security architecture. But I just want to go through a few highlights and touch on what different agencies are doing. These are just examples. Again, the list is almost endless. But one example, we've invested over $700 million to date to equip, train, and provide support to AU missions in Burundi, the AU mission in Darfur, and, of course, AMISOM, the AU mission in Somalia. Without that AMISOM mission, Somalia would be run by al-Shabaab right now. We can say that perhaps the AMISOM mission hasn't been as successful as we'd like it to be, but it actually has been successful. It has protected the TFG and kept Mogadishu from falling to some very unpleasant people. Another example, a $4 million project funded by the State Department to help the AU upgrade its command and control communications network, all as part of support to the Africa Standby Force. USAID provides support to ECHOWARN in West Africa and CWARN in East Africa. Those are the two early warning systems that will allow the AU and EGAD, give them sort of the analysis they need to prevent and mitigate conflict. We've been providing $2 million a year since 2001 for the construction and maintenance of a military supply depot in Freetown, and we're working now with ECOWAS to transfer the ownership of that facility completely and directly to ECOWAS. And then to touch on U.S.-Africa Command, I'm probably giving them short shrift, but they're doing all kinds of activities in Africa, capacity-building activities. They sponsored an exercise called Africa Endeavor this past August, brought together a large number of civilian and military leaders from 25 African countries. Again, this issue of interoperability of the communications network was sort of the topic of that exercise. So as I say, the list could go on. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention peacekeeping training, which is something that my office does. And it really is, in some ways, it's sort of the bread and butter of our capacity building effort on the continent. Peacekeeping training is really focused on national forces, but it still supports the regional efforts because at the end of the day, the standby brigades and the Africa Standby Force is going to be made up of units from national armies. So they're the building blocks. Since 2005, we provided training, equipment, and in some cases logistical support to 125,000 African peacekeeping troops from 25 partner nations. Not all of those 25 partner nations are active now under peacekeeping, but at one time or another, 125,000 troops from 25 countries. It's done primarily under the African Contingency Operations Training and Assistance Program, which is called ACOTA for short. The ACOTA program is about $50 million a year. And as the person who oversees this program at the State Department and as a taxpayer, it's a fantastic investment. First and foremost, it's providing the peacekeepers who deploy to UN and AU missions to keep the peace. So that's really, it's just incredible. As of June this year, there were 34,000 African peacekeeping troops deployed on these missions in Africa, almost 50% of the total. The second benefit we get from this is that after these troops deploy, they go home. And they are in their home militaries. They have become more competent. They've become more professional. And so they sort of become part of the whole issue of professionalization and modernization of African national armed forces. And third, when the time comes and these standby forces are stood up and actually organized, they'll be ideal candidates for that kind of service. And I should also add, again, this gets to the issue, the idea of partnership and building capacity. ACOTA is going to continue to train African peacekeepers, but we're also moving to a transitional phase where we're going to be providing the capacity to African organizations to do their own peacekeeping training on a sustainable basis. So we're providing more resources to training centers around the continent, and that's how it should be. So anyway, to conclude, just to make my basic point again, there really is meat on the bones of what President Obama said in Accra. When he said that the U.S. will work with you as a partner, not just with words, but with support that strengthens African capacity, he meant it. Through programs like ACODA, we are not out there doing it ourselves, but we're partnering with the AU and the sub-regionals and national governments to support the wider mission, to bring peace and security to Africa so that Africa can get on with the broader issue of economic development. So we're here to stay, we're here to help, and we're here to stay. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. I get a very optimistic picture here, and I don't know, we'll see how the audience feels, but it looks like a very sort of encouraging picture. And we would like to take a couple questions. The way I would like to do it is take maybe three or four, and then the panelists will respond, and then we go to another round. So when I say you, don't feel offended, but I'll say at the back there, and someone will give you a microphone, the one back, and then the next one. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Please be briefed and to the point.
Okay. Mohammed Waf from Middle East Broadcast Network. Since the title of this event is conflict prevention, and we had seen a crisis that started to loom today from Ethiopia after the prime minister had given an interview to the British news agency Reuters and talked about the Nile Basin and Egypt, and I have read in his quotes the word war several times. I wonder if Ambassador Rugunda might give us his take on how do you think any of the African organizations might help preventing such a conflict, a new conflict in the region, or even the help of the United Nations, and if not, what do you think this thing will unfold? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The Nile Basin issue. Okay, next one.
Well, really, my just brief comment and recommendation. I'm from Sierra Leone, West Africa. I'm with an organization called the International Forum for the Rights of Black People. If I could follow what the ambassador was saying, let's take Liberia for example. The peace is not going to be sustainable. For simple matter is, somebody who was involved in the crisis, if that person happens to become president in the name of a first woman president in Africa, it is good to other people. But those who are victims will never be satisfied. So my recommendation is this. If really we want to talk about Africa, look at the audience and see how many Africans are here. I came here 2000 by the State Department. I came with the understanding to help and how to resolve problems in Africa. But now I'm stuck here, frustrated, because I don't want to live here. But how can we communicate with the State Department genuinely and the Brookings Institute to look for individuals from the various African countries who we are patriots, who came here because of fear of their own problem in Africa, who were persecuted by the government and individuals. Since Africa loves America so much, how can America help us who are here, who want to live here, want to help and promote Africa?
Okay, so you have the question, you will both respond. Could I come in front here, the lady here, and then the gentleman over there? And then we'll answer those for her.
Thank you. Mine is just a general question. As we're talking about peace and security, looking at AFRICOM and the role that it will play in building capacity for both peace and security, how you feel that fits in with a stronger African presence and their capacity to address military problems, and how the State Department plans on working with the military in that capacity.
One more. The gentleman over here, please.
Okay. Yes, thank you.
My name is Aaron Magezi, and the question that I have for you is with regard to the UN Security Council Resolution 1540 to do with non-proliferation. And the point of my question is there are a couple of African countries that have not signed on to this resolution. What are we doing with regards to this? Because I think chemical weapons, biological weapons, and the influx of these terrorist groups, for example, the recent bombings in Uganda, are showing that this is probably going to be the next front for destabilization. Thank you.
We'll take another round, but Ambassador, and then Mr. You are wired.
Fine. So, if I may start with the first question from the Middle East, the impending war over the Nile waters. I do not think that the situation is as bad as there is an imminent war the way the question suggests. The fact of the matter is that the Nile Basin and the River Nile in particular has been under controversy for many years, and that is expected. It's expected because it comes from the center of Africa, and the life of people, especially in North Africa, Egypt and the like, depends on the Nile. The countries concerned, in order to avoid those problems, decided about 15 years ago to establish the Nile Basin Initiative. This is an initiative by 10 countries that fall in the Nile Basin. And actually, this happens to be headquartered in Entebbe, Uganda. But they rotate in terms of meetings and the like. The focus of the Nile Basin initiative has been not so much to fight for sharing of the water, but more to ensure equitable sharing of benefits of the Nile. And I think from that point of view, there has been a reasonable amount of understanding, and under Nile Basin Initiative, a treaty has been negotiated. It is now in the final stages, and I expect that to be signed in due course. One would want to see what Prime Minister Meles has said. It is true that Ethiopia has had some problems because it is putting up some dams to generate power. But Egypt, in particular, is rather concerned that the waters of the Nile may be being stopped by Ethiopia. But I think that under the mechanism in place of Nile Basin Initiative and the treaty being negotiated, the problem, in my view, should be able to be handled. So there may be no imminent war to report about. Number two, if that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, just be brief and so that you answer more.
Okay, fine. Sierra Leone, well, really, we cannot get the United States to do everything for us. I agree with the Speaker, Hoover, that the U.S. is doing very good work to support Africa. I think my own advice is that if you think the situation is reasonably secure in your country, go home and make a contribution there. If you think it is not appropriate being in Washington, make a contribution either to your country or to humanity. I think the last point I will comment on is Resolution 1540. A number of African countries that have not acceded to it, my point is that they should be encouraged to do so, because this is in the interest of their individual countries and also in the interest of international peace and security to ensure that chemical and biological warfare is prevented.
I just want to comment on two of the questions, the one from the fellow from Sierra Leone. If I heard you right, I think what you were saying was how can you, as a person living in the United States, you're a permanent resident or even a citizen, how can you communicate with the policymakers and have an impact that way? I think that's the way I understood it. And I think my answer to that is we in the U.S. government and at the State Department need to do a better job of connecting not just to people from Sierra Leone, but diasporas from all over. We're recognizing that there's huge value in engaging with those communities, but it's not something we've done traditionally. We've been very outwardly focused. We're diplomats. We have relations with other countries, and we're not so good at developing relations with communities here in the U.S. So, but that's, I think we recognize that weakness, and we're trying to do more outreach here in the U.S. with African diaspora populations.
AFRICOM.
AFRICOM, yes, right. Kind of a general question about sort of the balance between defense, diplomacy, and development, the three Ds as we call them. The way we see it, and I think, and we have a representative from AFRICOM here in the audience, one of my colleagues, we're not at war in Africa, so everything we do in Africa really is kind of under the policy lead of the State Department. AFRICOM, I think, accepts that, is very comfortable with that, and they see their role as very much a capacity-building role, not a war-fighting or a war-planning role. We only have one permanent military installation on the continent, in Djibouti. The headquarters is up in Stuttgart, Germany. And so as AFRICOM has stood up, when it first was established, I think it was wrongly perceived as something that was going to cause the militarization of American foreign policy in Africa, and that the Defense Department, AFRICOM, would sort of take over sort of our relationship with African countries. And that just hasn't been the case. That's not their role. They understand that. So really what AFRICOM does fits in. It's nested under the broader strategic policy goals that we have in Africa as sort of laid out by the diplomats. So it's a good relationship. It's a mutually supportive relationship. I just came back on Thursday, from a week of, it's called the Theater Security Cooperation Conference. It's AFRICOM's big annual planning conference. And there were 25 people, State Department and DCMs from our embassies in Africa. They were actively participating. Half of my office was there. Other people from the State Department was there. So there's this ongoing, constant dialogue on making sure that we're coordinated and that what AFRICOM is doing fits in under sort of the broader foreign policy goals.
Thank you very much. I would also point to people, if you are interested on some ideas about the Nile River Basin, Brookings has a posting not long ago about that, and we are hoping to have a Nile River Basin conference sometime next year. But it's an important issue. So I'll end up with, I'll start with the Minister, Honorable Suruma. He was a former Minister for Finance in Uganda. He's one of ours now.
Thank you very much, Mr. Manji, for the introduction. Honorable Rugunda, you mentioned that the regional organizations were originally economic, mainly economic organizations. But now they have taken over the role of security as well, because they see that you cannot have economic development without political stability. Now, the question I have is, are they, in fact, able to fulfill this new role of security? Are we not mainly depending on the magnanimity of a few countries that are willing to actually come in and assist, whereas many other countries are standing back? Say, for example, within either the West African region or East African region, Central Africa, a few countries will come in and do something, but there is really no mechanism. You talked about a mechanism, but I wonder if a mechanism is actually there, or what we have is a few countries under the name of regional organization, under the cover, if you like, and they're going ahead and trying to do something. So I'm commenting about the weakness of the regional organizations and the lack of capacity or authority structure to actually fulfill this role of security keeping. Thank you.
Okay. I'll take two. Please be brief so that we take a lot more. I'll start with this one question and then go to the other one there. A gentleman. Please be.
Thank you. Steve Landy, Manchester Trade. I'm troubled by the whole attitude of some of this presentation. I don't disagree. In fact, I agree with the point that the question of Africa doing the work and not looking at helping Africa. I view it differently now. In my view, Africa is a thriving economic force in the world. People are competing for it. China, European Union, with obnoxious kind of economic partnership agreements where they buy market share. So I disagree when I hear that the State Department has three Ds, but I don't see anything about U.S. commercial interest. You know, I hear development, diplomacy, I fully agreement, or whatever the third D was, and so on. It's there. I was listening to your speech. You're a finance minister. We have two people in Uganda. You're the growth area. So my problem is one more question. How do we keep the focus of talking about Africa's problems, which we do well, but also talking about Africa's potential and the fact that it's in the U.S. self-interest to begin to compete unless we're going to work up one day and we're going to find ourselves marginalized as a complete economic force while we've been doing all these good things in the areas that people have been describing? Thank you.
Thank you very much. That helps us also because we are very interested in U.S. investments, so we would like to hear the comments on that. May I take the gentleman right over there, please?
Hi, my name is Sam Sturgis, and I'm a student at American University. Each of you today mentioned Somalia. One ambassador you mentioned as a key issue of concern. Somaliland has been relatively stable and hasn't experienced the oppression of the Shabaab. And I was wondering if you feel that it was wise to recognize Somaliland and if the international community should do that in order to prevent conflict from spreading to that region as well.
Okay, very good. You didn't mention Puntland, but you just mentioned Somaliland. Okay, the gentleman over there. Okay, so let's start at the back, and then we'll come back in front. Oof. The one in the middle, then please be brief like that. We can take a little more.
Bob Berg, I was senior advisor for many years to the little sister of the Africa Union, the Economic Commission for Africa. You probably saw Mr. Ambassador across from the State Department is the new United States Institute for Peace, a kind of belated recognition that civil society has quite a role in fostering resolutions of disputes before they get into conflict. And I'm wondering what you see as the potential for developing African civil society, as it was, let's say, most dramatically in Liberia's case, to resolve conflict as an adjunct and ally of the official processes.
I'll take the gentleman at the back, then we'll come back this side. Thank you. Brief.
I'm Bienvenue from DRWDC. I want to thank the panel because it's a great discussion. But the thing I've been missing in the discussion was those who are in the bottom line of the equation, the civil society, the population. So, Ambassador Wenger, do you feel that maybe most of the time the population do not really agree or do not feel more comfortable with the international troops coming to their home country to try to secure whenever a crisis happens? And if so, what to do? Because in recent cases, or back in the old days, you had the case, the first accused the UN not being responsible for the genocide in Rwanda. And then if you take recently another case, you had the French troops in Cote d'Ivoire, where also they threatened some lives in Cote d'Ivoire. So apparently the population now does not believe in the trust or does not have this trust, feeling that the UN can keep them safe. So what do you think?
The lady at the, here, then we answer those questions. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Kunda Chinku. This question is for Ambassador Gwinda. What do you think will be the consequence of the failure of the UN to issue a formal response to the AU's request for the Security Council to invoke Article 16 to suspend the processes initiated by the ICC against President Bashir?
I knew it was coming. Okay, so Ambassador,
Fine. So what would be the consequence of the ICC indictment of Bashir, the request being rejected?
It wasn't rejected. There was no response.
Okay, fine. So I better start with that. It's true there has been a difference of opinion. In fact, there has been sharp disagreement within the Security Council over the indictment of President Bashir. The view of both the African Union and the members of African Security Council has been that the indictment of President Bashir, valid as it is, should be deferred under Article 16 of the Rome Statute in order to enable the peace processes going on in the Sudan to advance. And here what we have in mind are the talks in Doha over Darfur and also the implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, including the forthcoming referendum. Unfortunately, the dominant view of the Security Council is contrary to that position, and the indictments are continuing. I suppose the indictments will continue and the peace processes will continue in parallel. Let's monitor the processes, both issues simultaneously go on. Now, to my good friend Dr. Suruma's point of the capacity of the regional economic groups being able to manage security issues, it's a legitimate point. But I think this has come out of necessity, the realization that if you are at war with each other, you cannot talk of economic development. It is not that these particular groups are themselves having troops of ECOWAS or IGAD, no. It is true that they are using the troops of individual countries. Do they have the necessary framework or mechanisms? The answer is yes. Actually, the first one of the RECs to do so was ECOWAS, which did develop its framework and mechanisms about 10, 15 years ago. And using the authority of Nigeria, they have been able to really make a difference in West Africa, in my view, in a very positive way. IGAD does not have the troops, but the fact that they have helped negotiate the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in the Sudan, which to some extent is a security matter, has advanced peace and created an amazing environment for doing business in the region. So, in my view, it is correct that regional organizations have invested in the search for peace and coordinating the countries to work for peace. The issue of Africa's potential, and this was raised, actually I agree with the questioner that Africa has enormous potential. But this potential has not been optimally exploited because of the confusion and the conflicts that have characterized Africa. In spite of the conflicts, Africa is refusing, is resurging economically. So what is going to happen tomorrow when the conflicts are contained? The enormous potential will come up and Africa will be able to manage its security issues. I agree that the United States needs to be on the front line for the competition with other countries to invest in Africa, and really the doors are open for the United States to massively invest in Africa. Africa is looking for investments to be able to tap the potential. Somaliland. Is it wise to recognize Somaliland? I agree with the comments that Somaliland has done very well. But as our chairman talked of Puntland and other areas, some of us would be happier to see Somalia together. and perhaps the sobriety in Somaliland will help the rest of Somalia to work for peace and work for a united country. Civil society. The civil society, both African and international, plays very, very critical role in issues of prevention of conflict and working for peace. Actually, civil society organizations are at the front line of conflicts in terms of giving assistance and treating the wounded. But also in the struggle for peace, you find them reaching different groups in order to be able to bring them on the table for negotiations. They are able to mobilize the communities. They are able to reach governments. So if you want, civil society organizations are the actual implementers of peace and preventive measures in conflicts, because they reach everywhere, they know the information, and they can reach governments. And so far, in the conflicts in Africa, they have done very, very well. I think the last question, people not being comfortable with foreign troops, the answer in general is yes. But it depends on specific situations. I'll give you one example. Uganda was under the dictatorship of Idi Amin for 9 years. It required him to go and provoke Tanzania for Tanzania to mobilize 45,000 troops from Tanzania. They came, they were foreign troops. They liberated Uganda, and believe it or not, were ecstatic with the Tanzanian troops. They were our darling because they had liberated us. Therefore, it depends on what those foreign troops are doing. If they are coming to oppress you and suppress you, yes, people will say no. But if they are coming to stand by you so that you are liberated, you will embrace them. So it depends on the specific cases.
Okay.
Just if I could comment on two questions, the one about the commercial piece by the gentleman here. I mean, this discussion wasn't about commercial stuff and investment, but, you know, with my background, I can talk to you about that all day if you want. It's obviously, it's linked to peace and security, but in terms of commercial advocacy, we as a government don't do it very well overseas, and especially in Africa. I think the Commerce Department is typically kind of underfunded for that sort of thing. But far more important, I think, is the environment in Africa itself and the behavior of our companies in the private sector. We work very hard overseas to bring American businessmen to look at opportunities in Africa. They just don't bite very often. They're different from Chinese companies. Chinese companies just have a higher tolerance of risk than our companies do. Our companies look at the costs, they look at the risks, and they're just, for market reasons, they are more conservative, and our system is also different in that we can't tell our companies what to do. The Chinese government and others have a little bit more influence over their private sector, maybe, but those companies are just inherently willing to take on more risk than our companies are. And they're able to do things that our companies can't do legally as well. So there's a lot of things out there that put our companies at a disadvantage. But first and foremost, I think they need to come and see the opportunities and see the potential. Not enough come, and when they do come, they tend to get scared off. We do our best. We need to do more, but companies need to I think a little bit more creatively about getting involved in Africa. It would be great. We'd love it. The second question was Somaliland. Our Assistant Secretary Johnny Carson rolled out a speech a few weeks ago where he talked about our new what's called a dual track or two track policy. We are what that means is we will continue to provide support and capacity to the TFG, but we will also simultaneously reach out to other groups that are not associated with the extremist groups like Al-Shabaab, who are not affiliated with the TFG, but who are otherwise in, you know, want peace and security. These could be regional governments or local communities. So we will, in the coming months, be engaging more with groups in Somalia, with the Somaliland government. The issue of recognition, I think, is, you know, that's a perfect example of something. We wouldn't do that
we're going to look to the African Union and what African countries want to do before we would do anything like that.
Okay, I think we'll take the last round of questions. So if those people, all of the ones whose hearts are up could be very brief and specific, then we can be able to take that route. So we start here and then go that way. So we have about 6-7 questions, please. Brief.
I want to press Minister Suruma's point about whether these regional entities do have the capacity to do with it. I mean, when you look at the success of the regional economic communities, you give ECOWAS as an example. The ECOWAS model is one where there's a dominant group partner. Is that the model that will work? Because when you look at the other cases, there are very few cases of true success. And you did mention one of the obstacles, and that is vested interest. We've seen that countries that are close to the source of the problem have vested interest in it. And then there's a conflict of interest. If you actually balance the advantages and disadvantages, do you still come out on the positive side for regional economic communities if we're not using the ECOWAS model?
Okay. The gentleman next here. Then we'll go all the way. The lady over there.
Yeah. Chao Chen, freelance correspondent, Pacific Mailman. Dr. Rugunda, thank you for your coming. And since I'm more familiar with U.S., so my question will be on U.S. side. Director Fuller, you said that President Obama emphasized the U.S. Work with AU and the regional organization as a partner. My question is this: what's the personal behavior and attitude of the U.S. personnel should be? And also, you have talked about the division of labor and the communication between African of the Department of Defense and the AID of the State Department. And seems now more work for the AID, particularly is my perception, should be help develop the civil society. In this case, AID have lots more work. Should should State Department get some more fund from Department of Defense? Thank you.
Okay.
Interesting. The lady up there.
Caitlin Connell from the Charles Group. Mr. Hoover, the ambassador said that the number one factor complicating peace in Africa right now is drugs. Could you please expand on how the U.S. government is working with its African partner nations and organizations to counter the drug and narco-terrorism threat in Africa?
Okay, so we move to the gentleman there. We are moving backwards over there. Yeah, Sarah, and then...
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Tom, and I'm a fellow at the U.S. Peace Corps Programming and Training Unit. I have a question to the Ambassador Rugunda. Thank you very much for that laborious presentation. Mine is basically on two issues. Well, people have already talked about the region organizations. One question is, in your opinion, are you comfortable with the AU mediation support, for instance, its structures and policies? Secondly, goes to the idea of the civilian protection agenda. This is a challenge to the UN currently. How are the region organizations in Africa going to try and overcome this, because it is a very big challenge, as well as I'm sure you could be knowing about that. Thank you.
Ah, sorry. The lady there, then we got that side. Yeah, sorry.
Emma Osong with Catholic University. I have a rather simple question for our panelists this afternoon. Do you believe that some of the capacity building that you speak of and a lot of other institutions and organizations talk of do not simply reinforce the existing maintenance structures on the continent? And by that I mean simply going to reinforce the type of leadership that is fueling some of the conflict. I'd like to hear your opinions and impressions about that.
And then
thank you. My name is Ayo Shutumbo with Universal Human Rights Network.
Conflict, I believe, is a part of progress, and I believe every nation must go through one conflict or the other. So I don't believe that the conflict in Africa is the major problem. But what I see that is lacking here is the will of African government and government officials to question the source of weapons that lands in the bushes for the rebels. In the United States here, prior to this administration, we've had MoveOn.org that resents everything that came out of the presidency of Bush and the trio of Bush, Dick Cheney, and Rumsfeld. Today we have Sarah Palin and Tea Party who disagree with everything that comes out of the White House that we have now. But it doesn't necessarily result to arms and ammunition and killings. So the fact that we disagree with our government in Africa, why do we have to pick up arms in a country that some of them cannot even produce enough bread for their population, can carry AK-47? I know they cannot afford the AK-47. Why isn't anyone questioning the source of the weapons that it land in Africa? Thank you.
Okay. The camera, gentlemen. Okay, Voice of America.
Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Paul Ndiho, Voice of America Television. I wanted to take you back to Sudan, Dr. Lugunda. You talked about Sudan, and recently you led a team, the Security Council team to Sudan. I wanted maybe you to comment on the current situation on the ground, considering the fact that there is talk of tension building up between both sides, and a possible war breaking up between the tribes in the south and another war breaking up between the south and the north. Thank you.
Okay, that's an important issue of the south then, the referendum and the consequences. Do we have any other question? We can take one more, then we finish with the comments. Very good. Dr. Rugunda, I think you have quite a number, but briefly you can answer them.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. I'll just start with the last question of the Sudan. It's true that last month, Uganda, the United States, and UK co-led a UN Security Council mission to Uganda and to the Sudan. In the Sudan, we had good meetings with the leadership in southern Sudan. We went to Darfur and then Khartoum and had good discussions. Now, do we see war breaking up between the north and the south?
The weapons may be interesting.
My own assessment is that Sudan has been a complicated case, but so far it has been managed reasonably well in terms of the implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. My own assessment is that there is no cause for the North and South fighting, and that both sides have committed themselves to the referendum being held on the 9th, and I think let's wait for the results on the 9th. So a war is, in my view, unlikely to break up again between the two. How about a war between or among the ethnic groups in the south? This one has been hyped up mainly from the north, saying, "Are you fellows, if you vote for independence, all that will happen, you'll be killing each other within your respective ethnic communities." My assessment of the situation in the south is that the people in the south of the Sudan are really united, and they are ready for the referendum. As what they are going to vote for, let's wait for that. And I do not expect a war at all to break up within the South over this question. So I think the situation in the Sudan may be more optimistic than many people think, and the chances for fighting are not, in my view, very high. And let's continue to work so that there is no fighting, to support the people of the Sudan. Conflict. Somebody said, "You fellows, why don't you look for where the arms are coming from? And give a good example of the opposition in the U.S. here. It is true that because of weak institutions, weak systems, many of the African leaders and groups become vulnerable, including being vulnerable to peddlers of arms, which are reasonably available, and there are many merchants of arms ready to sell them. And if they get a weak point, they will jump and do so, which is not so easy for an established democracy like the United States. The issue of capacity building. Somebody suspicious about this capacity building and think it is one way of reinforcing dictators. I think really the capacity building we are talking about is not to support any individual leader, but to help Africa be able to more effectively and promptly respond to challenges in Africa. And I think, in my view, the capacity building under African Union and even under regional organizations is so far taking the right shape. The question of drugs, I'm glad this point has been raised and is addressed to my friend Hoover, who will answer it. Suffice it to say, the issue of drugs is a very, very grave matter, which is expanding not only in West Africa, but also in East Africa and other parts of Africa. Africa is no longer just a transit country. It is now a consuming continent. It's an area even where there is manufacturing of drugs taking place. The point raised by my friend Adeni Jones about the vested interests of regional economic groups, you may be right. However, when I compare the local prejudices and vested interests, I find that the advantages of building capacity and regional organization being involved are much higher and much more. As I have already said, IGAD has done very, very good work, both over the Sudan and even in Somalia. The Ugandan troops are in Somalia because initially of the support from IGAD, which was then embraced by the African Union. We should look out and minimize those vested interests. Burundi is now pacified because of the regional involvement by the countries concerned. The last comment was somebody raised a question. Tom raised the issue of, are you comfortable with AU mediation and mechanisms and structures? And you raised another point, a second point.
And then the second point was about the civilian protection agenda, which is currently failing in most of the countries.
Okay. First of all, the structures, in my view, of the African Union, I think are reasonable structures. Structures should not be rigid, and they are being reviewed as time goes on, and as and when there is need, there will be amendments to improve the structures depending on experience in the field. The question of protection of civilians is a relatively new agenda in international conflict issues. I think there is a good case for it, but sometimes people who support protection of civilians error on looking at civilians purely as if they are in a vacuum. I know at one stage Uganda was told, do not attack the Lord's Resistance Army. We said, why not? Oh, you know, they will kill civilians. So civilians now being used as hostages to keep criminals, murderers, unattended to. Therefore, while we fully endorse and support protection of the civilians' agenda, we must always go and correct the origin, the cause of insecurity for those civilians. And that's why Uganda, working with the regional countries, continues to pursue the Lord's Resistance Army in the Sudan, where it was, in DRC where it was, and in Central Africa where they are now. We think that's the most effective way to protect the civilians.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Very briefly, okay. The question about the division of labor and resources between USAID, DOD, and state. I think when this administration came in, I think it believed that that those three Ds were out of balance, diplomacy, development, and defense, that it was too heavily weighted in favor of the military. So there's been an effort the last 2 years to bolster diplomacy and development. USAID right now is going through a process where they are USAID really suffered over the last 10 or 15 years. And just if you look at their staffing numbers and their budgets, just a steady decline to the point where most of their programs are sort of run by contractors at this point. The Obama administration wants to turn that around. We're in the middle of doubling the size of the USAID Foreign Service right now. And so we're trying to bring some balance back. Whether we'll take money from the Defense Department's budget and give it to USAID, I don't know. With the new Congress and our budget deficit the way it is now, anything could happen. But there is definitely a desire on the part of this administration to bolster development and diplomacy in tandem with defense. And then the narco trafficking question. I said earlier, I'm still learning. I'm not completely up to speed on what we're doing. My very strong impression is that the issue, the problem, the challenge in West Africa has just exploded in the last few years. It has sort of caught people by surprise. And now we as a government, we're not terribly fast moving, but we're catching up a little bit. But we need to find more resources to, again, partner with African governments to combat this, because it's an unbelievably corrosive cancer. The narco trafficking really has the potential in places like certain countries in West Africa, just undermining the very notion of good governance and really destroying all the investments that have been made, by governments and by foreign partners. So we are recognizing that it's a huge problem, and we're trying to bring a little bit more attention and resources to bear. And then the last question about do we believe that capacity building reinforces bad behavior, basically? I think there's a book out every other week about whether foreign assistance generally, not just security assistance, is good or bad for countries. I think at least in terms of the kind of the security assistance capacity building programs we're doing in Africa, I think if that is leading to bad behavior, it's not because of those programs, it's in spite of those programs, because we seek very much to bring professionalism to African militaries, and that can only be good when they go back to their own countries from deploying in peacekeeping missions. Bad things can still happen. We hope they don't, but I think they're good investments, not counterproductive.
Well, thank you very much for an excellent discussion. Ambassador Ruguda, for coming all the way from New York to be with us. Mr. Hoover, for providing the comments, which are very useful. And for all of you for staying. We were worried, this is Thanksgiving week, and we had a, house full and very, very good questions and a lot of issues for all of us to really think about. And I would say, I think Brookings has a posting on the referendum that should show up. You previously published at the ROA Times, which raises some of the issues. And also, we are working on a lot of these issues that we think that unless you deal with them, you can't really talk about economic development. So we thank you for your support, and we look forward to seeing you here again. And for the panelists, let's give them a good clap. Thank you very much.